have some of those specific comments or what's going on these from Dan and Owen. Welcome.
Good morning, Commission. Secretary Roblin. Just a second, I'll get that PowerPoint put up. But Dan Cerny, resource supervisor here in the water town. With their concern here today is some of our management techniques that we use on octane production areas across the region. There's kind of that notion out there that, you know, what our ab tech crews do on an everyday basis, you know, just spray weeds. There's a lot more than that. And so once we get the PowerPoint up, we'll go into more details and all that.
For those on the line, bear with us. We're bringing up a PowerPoint presentation here at the meeting. Having some technical difficulties.
Good, Nick. All right, so here's an outline of what our regions are looking like in South Dakota. In that top right-hand corner is Region 4. We have three main offices, Aberdeen, Webster, and Watertown. Our habitat crews are basically based out of two main offices, and that's Watertown and Aberdeen. And when you look at that district, we have two districts, essentially, in Region 4, Roberts County, Grant, Dual, Connington, Hamlin, and Clark County is based out of the Watertown office. Then everything else is out of the Aberdeen office. Next slide, Nick. So one question, back when I was a conservation officer, I got a lot of questions on what do all these signs mean? Everything is kind of associated as game production ground or, you know, GFP property. And so that yellow sign in the top left-hand corner is what our game production signs look like. We have in Region 4, 319 game production areas totaling, you know, just close to 94,000 acres. The next sign below that, back up next, is our waterfall production ground. And this is one of those ones that we have in Paramount up in the Northeast region, but everyone kind of assumes that it's state land. And this is actually federal, U.S. Fish and Wildlife land. And then the rest of the signs down at the bottom, these are leased private lands, walk-in areas, crab, pull-up, and shack properties. And these are basically private lands that we lease for public mining access. Here's where I'll turn over to Owen to take over.
Okay, my name is Owen Macker. I work with the Habitat Program here out of Watertown. Basically, what I'll do here is just kind of go over our management practices, why we do certain things, and we'll basically be talking about Region 4, like Dan said. The other regions probably do things similar to us, but the crazy thing about South Dakota is the four regions are quite different as far as habitat goes, so things were probably done slightly different in each region. So the reason why we manage game production areas is to optimize habitat to maintain or increase wildlife populations, to showcase our habitat techniques and stuff on the GPA to show other, like, private individuals what they could possibly do on their land if they're looking to manage for wildlife, to provide free hunting and fishing and other recreational opportunities to the public, and to protect and maintain fragile environment. So I just threw this slide in here because I just like to show people that game production areas can be a lot more than just deer, pheasants, big blue salmon stuff. That there really is a diverse ecosystem out there consisting of a lot of different critters, plants, and on the picture you got, you know, our state flower, the pass flower, a really unique wetland plant called the wood lily, of course, bumblebee, grassland bird, a grasshopper sparrow. Their populations are in major decline because of the fragmentation of grasslands. And then a unique butterfly we found in Tiki Hollow, and then a wood frog that is kind of just popped out of nowhere here in the Northeast and has been studying with the letter U. So the cool thing here is just there's just a lot of neat things on GPAs, and like we said, there's other things to do on these GPAs other than hunting and fishing. It's like me and my kids go out to these areas all the time. I probably spend more time on them just having fun than actually working on them. So, you know, my kids probably took a lot of these pictures when we go out and hunt these areas. Next slide, please. So here, I'll talk to you about our woody habitat program. We usually like to plant shelter belts at least 8 rows or bigger just to provide winter habitat. We usually like to use, species that are native to this area. Back in the day, we planted a lot of species that would grow quickly, and they weren't from around this area, and they end up spreading a lot and becoming bigger problems for us that we're dealing with now. So native species, of course, get used by the animals in the area and provide good food and shelter for them, too. So when we're planting tree rows, we usually try to keep them about 12 to 16 foot apart so we can manage in between with mowing and keeping weed pressure down to allow these trees to grow well. I would say most of our plantings are prep now as far as they're going into a piece of farm ground. When I first started, it was still kind of a common practice, but it would be just to scalp cedars and pines, like right into sod. That we don't do that as much anymore. We might do that in between an old existing shelter belt to try to thicken it up. But it's just you can only really utilize two species, and that's like cedars and pines, because they're the only ones that can really compete with the grass you're scalping them into. Like I said, most of our tree plantings are used for winter cover. Other things, people might use them for are travel lanes. You can use a lot of different habitat that doesn't necessarily cost as much and provide just as much habitat, if not more, with travel lanes. So we don't typically use it for travel lanes anymore, just like I said, winter cover. We can go to the next slide. So the funny thing with the trees now is even when we try to plant them, the deer will actually try to make sure they don't succeed. So you see this picture on the left. It's basically a 7-foot electric fence that we put around our shelter belts now to protect the trees and let them get a good start. Deer are really... really rough on a lot of the species that we plant, like fruit-bearing trees. They'll destroy oaks and stuff like this. So this gives the trees about, depending on the type of soil they go into, like 6-year head start before we take the fence down and then just let them do their own thing. On the right, you can see the fabric rows. We typically use fabric now anytime we plant trees. That just kind of keeps the weed pressure down and not really have to use any more manpower to weed the trees. Back in the day, we used to have guys disc in between the rows constantly and then have a machine called a weed badger that would basically till the weeds up in between every tree row. So it would take one or two guys the whole summer just to weed the tree. So this kind of does it on its own. We can probably move to the next slide. So not only do we plant trees, but we also cut trees down. So with the scalping that I talked earlier, we have these feeders that now like to invade our grasslands where we necessarily don't want them. Shown here are some of the tools we use to to take these trees down. The red machine on the skid steer is called a Seacon. It's basically a big grinder on the skid steer. So you put it on top of the cedar and just go down with it, and it will grind it up into sawdust, basically. The next skid steer picture is a tree shear that can basically shear off and pile trees into a stack so you can burn later. That tree, the shear can take up to a 13-inch diameter tree out. And then you got the old handy chainsaw. So, you know, this is showing all cedar work. Cedar work is nice because as soon as you cut that cedar off at the base, that tree is dead. If you do this to a deciduous tree, like the ones we have problems with spreading are like Russian olives or, let's say, buckthorn or Sabine elm, they will start to regrow right away. So a lot of times when we're doing those types of species, we have to treat it with a herbicide to kill the tree. This is just a picture that shows a before and after of that Seacon work. It is a pretty nice machine. You know, it takes time, though. You know, and our ground, if you guys have ever been on it, is fairly rough, so you almost have to go to a chiropractor afterwards doing this type of work in that machine. So, next picture. Another tool we use to control invasive woodies are is fire. And this is a quick tool if the trees are small enough. If, you know, a cedar starts getting over 6 foot, depending on the vegetation and burning, it won't consume the tree, because if you don't actually engulf that whole tree in flames, if there's still parts of it that's green, that tree will survive. And again, with deciduous trees, if you burn them, they will start sprouting from the base again and will not die. So it is a tool, but it's a tool that needs to be used fairly early as far as cedar control goes. So, all right, I'll talk about grasslands a little bit here. So where we are located on eastern South Dakota, we're kind of right on the edge of the tall grass prairie and the mixed grass prairie. These prairies are basically tall and mixed grass because of precipitation. You know, over here on eastern South Dakota, we get a little bit more rain than they do further west. So you just get a bunch of different species that are adapted to a little less rain. So the tall grass prairie is kind of funny because it is right on the edge of grass and wanting to turn into woodland because we get enough precipitation for trees to naturally grow. So if the grass isn't in a healthy state or assisted with you know, natural fire, trees will invade and basically become a forest. So, you know, so there's different types of grasslands. You know, we say native prairies. That means not ever been broken by a plow, basically. So it formed after the glaciers came, and it's still in the same state that it was originally. So our non-native, I shouldn't really say non-native because we'll do native grasslands, but our other plantings, there's tame grass prairies that people planted for mainly cattle production and hay production. We'll do our what we call our native grass plantings, which we plant native grasses and forbs to try to mimic a native prairie as much as possible. And then we also have DNC that we used to plant a lot of, which consists of intermediate wheatgrass, sweet clover, and alfalfa, which is usually just a mixture that is cheap and used to provide nesting cover. Next, please. So this is just a slide on our native grass planting. You know, we used to do a lot of monocultures, basically solid switchgrass stands just to provide like winter cover or deer bedding cover. We have now went more to diverse stands of grass and forbs just to provide, you know, the diversity in itself provides just a lot of different plants and habitats for different for animals. So the flowers and stuff will provide pollinators, pollinating insects, you know, food, which will bring in predators for those insects, which will provide food for pheasants when they're chicks. And just a diverse ecosystem in general is just a more stable ecosystem, because if we just have one type of grass out there, if something were to come in and start wiping that grass out, we basically have an ecosystem that is going to get destroyed. So yeah, there's different types of way we plant these things, drilling and overseeding. Overseeding is just the way like Mother Nature does it. We throw the seed on top of the ground and let the weather bring the seed into the soil. Drilling is the other method. You know, you just use a seed drill to drill the seed in. The nice thing about overseeding is we can basically do it any time during the winter, fall or spring. Drilling, you're usually either you got a window in the fall or the spring to do it. So we typically are doing more of the overseeding now just because it opens our window to do more planting. And we do a lot of our plantings in the fall, which opens our spring window to do more food plots, tree planting, or fire as management. So when you plant grass, it's kind of like a surprise what you're going to get the next year. These pictures here show, you know, a first year grass planting on each side. You know, the left side, you know, you all of a sudden you roll the beets and you get all this bull thistle and Canada thistle that you're dealing with, and it just looks like a nightmare. And on the right side, you plant that and in the next year, and it looks exactly the way you pictured it would look like. Through management, we, you know, a lot of clipping and stuff like that. We, in fire, we try to get the left to look more like the right. So, like I said, burning is one of our management tools to try to control woody vegetation. It's also a tool to keep grass plants healthy. As, you know, many of you guys probably know, our prairies developed under a grazing and fire regime, so they just naturally respond well to fire. Fire as a tool is non-selective, so when we run a fire across the landscape, it basically, you know, burns up everything and starts the whole system over. It can be done in a day, you know, relatively quick tool, but it, you know, you got certain parameters that you have to use it within. You know, we're not going to use it in a drought situation. We need proper winds because we're not going to smoke people out, or, you know, if we have a busy road that's along the south side, we're not going to put smoke around it because, you know, we just don't want to cause any accidents with any vehicles like that. So we prep all these areas for fire, and, you know, we might not get to them all just because you also need special weather conditions and stuff like that to do it. So grazing is another tool. Like, you know, like I said, the prairies were developed under a grazing and fire regime. So, you know, we're basically using cattle now to mimic what the bison did back in the day. You know, the nice thing about cattle is they're guaranteed. Like when I said, the fire is no guarantee because there's certain restrictions that keep us from doing it. Usually when we talk to a private landowner about putting cattle on the property, that's usually something that will happen no matter what. So, the nice thing about cattle is they recycle nutrients. A fire will take most nutrients away. Which is good and bad. So when the cattle go through, they'll recycle nutrients. We can still target our cool season invasive grasses with early spring grazing. And they're kind of non-selective. So you create habitat that's more diverse. It's where you're going to have tall clumps of grass standing in some places and short grass, and different species will utilize that, you know, differently. So most of our grazing is done in the springtime from May 1st to June 15th, you know, and we're really trying to target the cool season invasive grasses, which are smooth grown and Kentucky bluegrass. You know, Kentucky bluegrass is just that, is our lawn grass that we have growing in town, you know. So it is a very aggressive grass because we've made it that way. So we have to actually be fairly aggressive with our management tools to try to manage it. The picture that you're seeing now is a picture of aggressively going at it with cattle. So we basically went at this grass planting like we would with a fire, and we tried to remove all the vegetation, which would have been done in the springtime when you're growing Kentucky bluegrass growing. The next picture will show the response from the warm season grasses after those cattle were pulled. So by strategically placing those cattle on in the spring and pulling those right when the warm season grasses are growing, we basically give them no competition with cool season grasses, and then the warm season grasses just blow up. So that's one way that we use grazing as a tool, you know, and, you know, to hammer it like that. Other ways is to, you know, do lighter grazes where they just selectively go out and graze certain areas and leave kind of like a very mixed result when they graze. So another tool we use, of course, is cane. This isn't a tool that we use as much as we do with the fire and grazing. It's just a tool to remove the stagnant old growth grass. We use it a lot more now for fire breaks and starting grass plantings over. So if we have a brome field that is, you know, like a solid brome, we'll go in and have a producer hay it off, and then we'll come in with glyphosate and terminate the brome, and then we'll interseed a native grass planting in there, you know, just a way to do a quick restart instead of going in and farming that area for 3 or 4 years. And so we just get our results that we're looking for a lot quicker, you know, habitat on the ground. So, next slide, please. So when I first started our food plots, you know, we basically were just hiring all our food plots out, either contract food plots where we were paying like $100 an acre to have a tenant come in, or we were doing a one-third, two-third, which the tenant would plant everything and be able to harvest two-thirds of it and then leave a third standing for wildlife. When I started, we started taking those plots over and doing things ourselves. It really allows us to do more different plantings. Like basically when the tenant was doing it, we were just strictly planting corn. This taking it over ourselves allowed us to diversify our plantings, and that two-thirds, one-third planting, you know, you might have had 36 acres, devoted for a food plot to have a 12-acre food plot. Now we have a 12-acre food plot still, but we also have, you know, another 24 acres that got planted back to habitat. So with planting food plots ourselves, you know, we were able to go to corn, you know, soybeans, sorghum, sunflowers, brassicas, you know, brew mixes, and we're even able to play around with like our corn mixes that, you know, we can interseed into our corn now. Like, we've got drills that we can plant corn, and when it's 4 inches, we can interseed a cover crop within the corn. So we've got, you know, our main food source of corn food plot, but we also have things growing in between that flower and provide rooting cover for pheasants and, you know, pollination for insects. So the next slide shows a brood mix. You know, this is a mix that we give out to landowners to plant on their own land too, and it just provides a bunch of pollination and attract a lot of insects, which are really good for pheasant chicks. This would be similar to the mix that we also plant in between our growing corn rows or a second year corn food plot, which if we find a corn food plot that really didn't get utilized, we'll just go in and overseed these brood mixes and then have this grow up in between the dead standing corn. That just kind of shows the understory of those brood mixes. You know, they're just designed so like those chicks can almost move freely underneath overstory of cover, so and find insects beyond. So I just kind of touched on this stuff. This is something I could talk about for days. So if you guys have any questions, we'll take them now. Or if you ever have any questions, feel free, you can call me if you want to talk about habitat, because this is something I can talk about forever. So.
All right, great presentation. Any questions from the commission? No, your team does a great job. I mean, everything you're doing out there, just the accomplishments you guys are making is amazing.
Thank you.
Great job.
Thank you. Presentation.
Oh, one commission, one question. Mr. Risler.
You had talked about the grazing and bringing the cattle in. I'm just curious, what are those relationships like with those cattle owners? Are they the same folks?
Yes. So we usually stick with the same tenants as long as we have a good working relationship with them and they're doing what we expect. The Fish and Wildlife Service, when they graze, I think they go out to a bid system, something we would like to avoid just for the fact that if we have a good working relationship with one guy, then we can kind of expect to see what we want to see.
Mr. Beast, you were mentioning about the one-third, two-thirds thing, since you took it over, how many more acres of habitat or food plots have you done in your area?
So, I would say Aberdeen and Watertown's pretty similar, and we're probably each planting about 400 to 500 acres ourselves now. And that consists of row crop and cover crops. And so we're planting in food plots, not only in the spring, we're planting them all the way through the fall. Yeah. So I would say we probably, when it was just tenant planting, we were probably around that 200, 300 acre mark, per Watertown and Aberdeen. So we've increased our food plots a lot.
Additional questions? Director Christian.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make one other comment. Two, actually. Number one, when you saw the slide up there, and Owen and Dan were talking about just the number of GPAs up here in the Northeast. When you look at it from a statewide perspective, approximately one-third of our total GPAs are up here in the Northeast. So our crews are extremely busy and do a fantastic job of working on habitat improvements and enhancements up here. And it's a daunting task. Those of you that are farmers know how busy it is in that small window that you have to get a lot of work done. Now think about all those scattered across the region. So they do a fantastic job of planning and organizing to get that work done. Secondly, an important one that I want to share is that Owen was talking about prescribed burns and grazing and haying as tools to manage the grassland habitat in our GPAs. And every year we'll get questions, we'll get concerns, or in some instances we'll get complaints about, us going out as an agency and doing prescribed burns or grazing and taking away that habitat. And it's always an educational opportunity when you do get those calls and explaining why we use those tools, because quite honestly, there are some individuals that just don't understand the importance of managing the grassland and those tools that we use. And that important message is these are always short-term activities for long-term gains. And when you see that GPA that you go to and you saw, oh, they did a prescribed burn or they did cattle grazing or something, and then they're frustrated because it may have taken away. But the important message, and again, it's an educational and opportunity for us to explain why we do those management tools. Those are short-term losses for long-term gains. And so I just wanted to share that again in case you ever get questions about that. Please don't hesitate to relay those folks to our local staff. They'll walk them through the reasons, the steps, and the timing that we do those activities, because those are strategically planned out and they're done for a reason. And the ultimate reason is to make better habitat, long-term habitat for wildlife game on a long-term basis. So if you you get those, please feel free to send them to us, and we'll have those conversations with the public.
Thank you, Director. And I'm glad Officer Sternhagen mentioned that the WPAs are not managed by the department. I've had a lot of calls from people saying, why is this piece of ground grazed all the way down, and what are you guys doing? And it turns out to be WPA, and we are not in charge of that. So I was glad that was mentioned. But, again, good presentation, and thank you for all your guys' great work and great outcomes.
Thank you.